You're listening to Adoption, Fostering and Tea from the UK's LGBTQ+ adoption and foster charity, New Family Social. Find us at newfamilysocial.org.uk. I'm Tor, and this week I'm going to be having a cup of tea with Henry and Duncan, who've had their children with them now for 4 years. Hi, both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Hiya, thank you so much for joining me. It's lovely to talk to people who've had their children for a long time and it hasn't beaten them yet. So can you tell me a little bit about your setup? You know, who are you both, and tell me about your children a little bit as well.
So I'm Henry, and we've got two children. They're twins, William and Charlie, and they're both now 8 years old.
I'm Duncan, and we live abroad. We adopted in the UK, in the UK care system, and our children were in the UK care system. But after a number of years of living in the UK, we decided to move abroad with them.
Lovely, thank you so much. So we first met because you volunteered at summer camp, didn't you, a couple of times? And, you know, I remember key moments of that, which I won't embarrass you by going into, but they are some of my funniest memories. But it was lovely to have you there. Can you take us back maybe to then and say, at the point that we met and you were volunteering, what you were hoping to get from that and what stage you were at in your own process?
So I think many people who are considering adoption will know that one of the requirements is to have voluntary experience. And I always think it's that idea that perhaps social workers in the assessment process want to make sure that you fully know what you're going into. Maybe you've been broken a little bit by that experience as well, just to get a real sense of some of the challenges. But it's actually really difficult, or we find it very difficult, to find volunteering opportunities with the right group of children, if I can use that word, so that you could really understand the needs of children you might be adopting. So when the opportunity to be a volunteer came forward, it felt ideal for us. But we also knew it was really important that we could learn from other adopters, and camp opened up so many opportunities to us to allow us to meet a network of people that could support us, that identified within our community, and also to learn from the other adopters who were able to share their experiences with us.
Yeah, for example, so we actually came to summer camp twice, because the first time we were very much early on in the stage and we were still, you know, thinking about our own adoption process, and the second time we were in the family finding stage and that was taking a while, and so we thought, actually, we enjoyed it last time, let's go and be volunteers again. We can't come with our children, which we'd want, I'd hoped maybe to do, but let's be volunteers again. But the first time that we were there, one of the things that I particularly, and I think both of us found it challenging, is, you know, you go through a lot of information meetings, and I think we may have by that point started or about to start the process with our voluntary agency that we went through. And there were a lot of stories about how difficult it was and how, you know, what children with, you know, really severe needs and backgrounds that are really challenging and that you really need to be prepared for it. And there was a point where it was like, oh my days, is this really what we're going to do? And what would our life be like? And are we going to be, you know, permanent carers for really, you know, children that need lots and lots of support and care? And what was really nice about camp was that, yes, you could see that these are children with additional needs sometimes, or have different interactions or different reactions than you might expect. But actually what was really nice to see was there were families with children being families with children. And it was really nice to experience and hear from people that actually it was achievable. And yes, there were its challenges, but it's also normal and achievable and lovely and fun and, you know, lots of warm things. And that was really missing in that process up to that point.
Yeah, I found that myself as well, that the horror stories piled on horror stories piled on horror stories, to the point that all I was left with was, these are unparentable children. That's all I'd got. And then we went to summer camp and realized pretty much what you did, that, yeah, there are challenges, but it's not, I always hate to say it's unmanageable, because I know for some families it can become that way, and I never want to sort of minimize that. But I guess in the majority of cases, it is about managing challenge and also experiencing joy. And I think the joy bit had been really lost from the narrative.
Yes, absolutely. There are lots of standout moments from a camp. Obviously, meeting you was a standout moment.
Well done, just as I scripted it.
But two things that stood in my mind. One is that we are a bilingual family, and we're based now in the Netherlands, and I'm trying to learn Dutch. Our children are, I think, thriving at learning Dutch, given that they only got introduced to the concept 4 years ago, and a number of those years were the pandemic. But the thing that stood out for me was talking to a couple who were from Wales, and we were telling them that we had been to an adoption fair and talked to social workers in London who said, you know, don't try to bring up your children bilingually. And they were very negative of our hopes. And I think that they felt, and this is my kind of projection onto them, that we were, you know, highly academic people coming along wanting a family, and that we had high aspirations for these children. And actually, we just wanted to make sure that they had the chance to interact with our family members. And this Welsh couple said, if you said that as a social worker in Wales, you know, that would be shocking. And the fact that they really encouraged us that you could bring up adoptive children bilingually, that was possible, that could be encouraged, that was really reassuring. The other conversation we had was with somebody who had twins. And at that point, we had just heard about and learned about our children. And they said, oh, it's good to have twins because they go at the same space and they kind of need the same things. And it's organizationally a lot easier. Now, twins, we experienced 4 years later, do have their own specific needs that are unique to twins. But it is really handy that you can order 40 pairs of the same size trousers in one go.
So you're bulk buying trousers.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting what you say about the bilingual comments that you had, because we did another podcast with a family who were also massively discouraged from helping the children to become bilingual. And again, it had gone really, really well for them. So I think there is a bit of a myth in the system that this is somehow either harmful or too much pressure, when in fact loads of children grow up bilingual in their homes. You know, so I guess, you know, the older the child is, perhaps there are more challenges. I'd be interested in how did you introduce that, given that they were four when they came to you?
So it's really interesting because I find language really interesting and the language learning process. So I was also looking at it from a kind of, I was really looking at how they were appreciating language. And I think what for me stood out, so I volunteered at a place where there were sort of mixed Dutch-British families as part of my volunteering experience. And there are different ways that you can approach bilingualism, and quite often it's a kind of one parent, one language, but there were also some parents there who were like, you know, I don't understand, quote unquote, understand my children if they speak in English to me. I only understand them if they speak in Dutch, to try and make sure that they actually actively use the second language, the minority language, rather than the majority language, which in the UK would be English, and then Dutch would be the minority language in our case. But I felt that given they came from a place of attachment history, that really wouldn't be the right approach for me. So I started really early on trying to say Dutch words and sentences, but also often doing it in English, and then slowly phasing out the English and more Dutch. And it was interesting because it's a four-year-old. So, you know, both our children were like, I don't understand most of the things that parents around me are saying, so I don't understand this either, and whatever. And at some point, they would realize that actually this was a different language, and that was interesting because that at some point clicked with them, and they go, oh, can you say that in English? And then I sometimes would and sometimes wouldn't. And then at some point, they started recognizing things in context. So if I was giving them a wash at the end of the day and I wanted their arm or leg, now arm is roughly the same, in Dutch is as the sound is in English, but leg's a very different word. But in the context of me washing them, they would know I now need to sort of stick up my leg so I can, you know, get that washed. But then you'd sit later on be like, oh, there's something on your leg. And they'd be like, huh, what? What's this?
Yeah.
And so it was really context specific that they started to learn the words. And then they went, oh, no, it's not about the washing. It's about this thing that I call a leg is also called something else in a different language. And that clicked. And then they started to think, oh, okay. They started to understand some bits of what I was saying, but not others. And sometimes that would be a half sentence and they'd be like, what does this word? And then they'd say five in English. And at some point they started to learn they were individual words and then they started using some of it. But what they really never had, and until we moved here, was because they could speak in English to me and I would respond. It was they never really had a need to speak Dutch. So they might use the odd word or things that they knew or with my family members. They would use the odd word, but they would also speak English. And you know, my parents and my sister, you know, they would just respond to them in Dutch, but they would listen to the English. And it wasn't until we moved here and that they went to a normal Dutch primary school, because they were so fluent in the sense of understanding that it could just stream into the mainstream system. But they were really frustrated the first few weeks that they were like, my friends don't understand me. And I'm like, yes, no, they don't. And you understand them and respond in English. And you assume, because you've had that all around you, that people just understand you. But actually, these are other four, you know, by that point, they were 7 and 6 year olds. These are other children around you that don't understand that English. And that really forced them to step up their game in terms of actively using Dutch. And now they do that quite well, still with a bit of English structure sometimes in their sentences. But we were talking to school the other day and they said, actually, we don't really hear them use English words or English sentences anymore other than anglified Dutch words. But, you know, that'll come out with the wash as well.
That's so interesting. I think it's fascinating. My passion is sign language and lots of stuff around children having both British Sign Language and spoken English. So it might be the child of a deaf parent, for example. And again, at certain points in their language development, they might appear to be behind in one or the other, but they're perhaps not quite because they're juggling two. But very quickly, that having two languages becomes beneficial. And so I think it's a really exciting opportunity that they've got, the fact that you know, they will eventually, fairly quickly, I guess, be fluent in two languages.
Yeah, hopefully. It's interesting that it's also interesting that they keep making the same mistakes in both languages. And so sometimes their teachers are like, oh, this must be because of English. I'm like, no, they make that mistake in English as well. So it's just a mistake. So like, for example, they often write numbers the wrong way around. I'm like, no, they did that. And that's because in Dutch, you start with, you know, the second, you don't say 21, but you say 1 and 20.
Right,
and
yeah.
They're like, oh, it must be because in English it's different. I'm like, no, they also do this in English, actually.
Yes.
The other thing they don't use his and her. They often say he's and she's, and they do that in Dutch as well.
Nice,
and like, oh, it must be because they're still a bit behind. I'm like, no, they're very consistent in the mistakes that they do make across two languages.
And Duncan, how's your Dutch?
Not so good. It's a klein beta spreken. So it's really an interesting relationship for the children, and because I can order a coffee and I can take them to their swim lessons, but they quite often act on my behalf, and I think it can be triggering to their sense of security and safety that they know that I might not always understand an interaction. So sometimes they will try to parent me, and I think that's one of the challenges which we've had to have conversations with them about, is that if I'm to learn, I need to practice, but also we are still safe if we can't order the hot chocolate in the full Dutch that we're expecting to do it, you know, that it is okay that I am making errors. So I think that's an interesting tension, but they're also great at correcting me, which is really a joyful experience when your child is constantly telling you to be more guttural in your tone. So that sort of helps me and sort of doesn't in the same way.
But it's interesting what you said about the safety, about that that's challenging for them. It isn't something I would have thought of, and I can see why they might think that. They might view that in that moment you aren't able to do everything, which I guess young kids want their parents to be able to do. So it's really interesting that you've spotted that and then managed it.
And it also plays into the fact that they had between them Charlie more than William parentified behavior. And so, you know, wanting to look after, Charlie wants to look after his brother and make Ed feels that sometimes we're not doing the job well enough. And so it's quite natural for children to act on behalf of their parent in a kind of bilingual situation. You see it often with, you know, people with a migrant background, that their child might be the one that sort of helps the parent that doesn't quite fully understand the language of the country that they're living in. But there's this interesting additional effect with us that they do have already that tendency for parentified behavior, but given the experience that they've had. And so for me, it plays into that sort of wider context of how that, there's more at play here. It's sort of a natural behavior, but at the same time with us, there's also an unnatural element to it because of what they've experienced in the past.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I think that sometimes an observer who doesn't know about children who've been adopted or fostered might just think, oh, that's really cute. Look at how they're looking after their younger sibling. Look at how they're looking after you. And actually, yeah, it's not always a behavior that you want to encourage because it doesn't come from a good place. It comes from a place of desperation and fear and things like that. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting that you've noticed that. So your children came to you when they were four. And you've now been at it 4 years. I know that when you were back in the UK, you had some support with them and stuff. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess, talk me through from when they arrived with you through some of that support, perhaps to the point that you left the UK, that period of time?
Yeah. So I'll maybe do the, I will talk about our kind of overarching arc of timeline, because the timeline in itself is actually really important. They were placed with us in December 2019. So for those that will remember, that was when COVID was just in the news as something to be aware of. And we were really focused on being placed with children and not reading the news. Then we had our period of being locked down as a family and not seeing anybody. And just as we started to open up our lives and come out of that kind of just being placed experience, and the boys were starting to go to nursery, and they'd started for the first 4 weeks of nursery, we then started with the first national lockdown. And I recall there being really great confusion about whether or not the boys were actually still vulnerable children or not, and whether or not they could access emergency childcare. And that was, for all of us, an immensely scary and difficult time. For our boys, I can't imagine what that must have been like, because, you know, our local pub on the corner was all boarded up. All of the playgrounds were locked up. And suddenly they were no longer in the nursery they'd been going to and being introduced to, but they were in another room with much smaller and younger children. And we debated, you know, should we not tell them about this pandemic to scare them? And then it became obvious that we did have to talk to them about it because it was going to last for a long time. And then it goes into a huge blur for me where I forget what day, month, or year it was, and we had to really deal with some large parental violence at home, particularly from one of our boys who was very scared, and to get them to sleep every night you were being hurt, and that was really hard when you couldn't take a break. So our survival method right at the beginning was a daily trip to buy essential, and I have to underline the word essential, Toblerone. the would not have survived without that Toblerone.
I understand.
And eventually, we were at the point where we thought maybe this placement would break down. It was that intense. And
it
then
must
we
have been horrible for you. I mean, just focusing on that kind of bedtime routine where you're being physically hurt. How did you each cope with that? Were you taking a child each, or was one of you doing it and then the other, or what were you doing?
We started off with the routine that we had established was that we would alternate with putting to bed the children. So one night I would do it, the other night Duncan would do it, and we would sort of try and then we would swap over as well. So I would read the story, and you know, and then we would swap over to the, I would swap over to the other boy to sort of do that. But what quickly became apparent was that William, who had sort of had got the most difficult time and was being quite violent, actually was more attached to Duncan than to me in that moment, and would be even more aggressive and bigger outbursts with me. And so we had to make a decision. And actually, in terms of the support that we had, we'd already, because we knew the boys came with some needs, and we'd heard all the horror stories, and so we were like, we better get kind of, you know, a kind of psychologist in to sort of talk through some of the things that we might come across, and if we don't need it, then we can phase it out again. But our voluntary agency had them in house and was able to provide us someone with, and we met them actually. Turns out it was also someone who had volunteered at camp. So we knew each other, and he came around once to talk things through, and then the lockdown happened. So most of it was via Zoom, and it was a really helpful vent as well when we were seeing all these challenges. But in those conversations, we agreed actually we need to reduce the amount of conflict. And so Duncan did most of the bedtime routine with William and got the brunt of it, which I find really challenging because I could hear it. And I had to be there to reassure Charlie very much, because he was being really scared with all the noise. And, you know, the things that happened in their background before they were placed into the care system were usually things at night. So it must have been incredibly triggering for him as well to hear what was going on. It was noisy, and it was loud, and it sounded like violence. But, you know, we knew it was child-to-parent violence, but in his mind, it may have been the other way around.
Yeah.
And, you know, because he couldn't see or couldn't hear. Well, so couldn't see but could hear.
Yes.
And that sort of really intense period lasted for, you know, it slowly built up as lockdown happened. And I think by mid-April, we were having the biggest violent outburst that we had. And then it took about 2-3 months for that to calm down. And by summer, we had found a way of like going outside, going for walks, so that a lot of the aggression could be directed, you know, in an environment where there wasn't things to throw at us very easily.
Yes.
Or where you know, the mere walking was actually also a way of dialing down stress hormones and burning up the energy that was clearly coming up in those times. And also things were calming down lockdown wise and I think that also made a kind of feeling of increased safety. But it was that combination of, you know, having just gone through one disruption of placement, then the second disruption of COVID. But and that was really interesting was that both of them, but particularly William, who's coping with it the least well, was this worry about my birth parents will die.
Okay.
Yeah. Are they still alive? Are they okay? Are they safe?
Yes.
And that was something that he voiced, which was good in a way. But both of them did that, but, you know, with William, it was particularly that it came out as a kind of violent outburst.
Which must have been terrifying for him, because that thing of, you know, being moved through a system that they have so little control over, then a pandemic comes and, yeah, for an adult, you could pick up the phone and check on someone and all of that. And they're separated from that for reasons that, of course, we as adults understand. But for them, yeah, it must have been really frightening. When you said that you got to points where the adoption could have broken down, is that a conversation that you ended up actually having between you?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was kind of like, we don't want to, but can we cope with this? And it was also for us to then say, so we had the psychologist that supported us, but he also recognized that actually there was a limit to what he could offer us in that stage, other than being a sounding board and being able to talk through things and techniques. And that was, I can't stress it enough, incredibly helpful in those moments, because there were things that we were trying to do in, with good intention, but it, you know, pointed out that it might not work. And, yes, you know, would there be better ways? But then, you know, there was a kind of, actually, we should bring in further support. And so we went back to the social workers. And actually, us saying as well, we feel really close to, you know, this may not continue. If this continues like this, we won't be able to see if we can cope with this. Also triggered them into action in a way that otherwise may not have happened. And so we were able to start accessing a plan for further support.
Because I think it would have been quite difficult. The boys were placed much further away from the local authority that was responsible for them. So them visiting was limited. And then, of course, during lockdown, it was WhatsApp calls, which is really difficult for them to gauge how things were going. And I think it was being able to be so stark with them about that we didn't need support, that we wouldn't apply for the adoption order until we did get support, that really helped to focus everybody's mind on what we needed to do. It helped that we had done quite significant research before about what type of support was available, because sometimes it is very helpful to come with a suggestion. And so there was the fact that we had a psychologist there to help us. And I think those weekly calls were very valuable to have that space. And actually, we continue to have weekly calls in one form or another with a therapist. And that allows us to maintain our relationship and also to think through some of the issues that we face. We then did a training course, which was the Great Behavioral Breakdown training course, which I think was helpful for understanding how to support them and also how to deal with the violence that we experienced. And then it developed from there by thinking, actually, perhaps there's an underlying sensory need. And we were able to, through the Adoption Support Fund, apply for two types of funding. One was the BUS model, which is about supporting sensory integration. And then the other one was around parent intervention training, where we were reviewed on video by a psychologist, and then we talked about that.
And that was through the National Adoption and Fostering Centre.
Yeah.
Which we knew about and actually was relatively close by, but they are a national centre. So, and for them, Teams and lockdown turned out to be really quite helpful because they could do more and help more people further away, because everything suddenly we were very familiar with working with online things. And but, you know, what I think is important to bear in mind is that we really had to push. We had to push at every stage, and we had to chase, and we had to be there. And, you know, has the funding application been submitted? What else information do you need? Have they come back yet? Because, you know, I'm sure the social workers meant well, but organizationally it was chaos. And there was, you know, applications were told that we were submitted, and then it turned out they weren't, or they hadn't been done with the full information. And then the Adoption Support Fund closes sort of, you know, for a couple of months after the start of the financial year, or before the financial, can't remember quite what, and then everything sort of falls down again, and then you have to wait again till the next financial year starts. And it was just, you know, the process of getting the support in place, you know, it wasn't until a year and a half later, after we had said we want to start with these two sensory interventions and the intensive parent training, I think it's called, personalized intensive parent training, PIPT, or the child parent game is also what it's sometimes called. It took a year and a half before that actually finally started, because first there had to be an assessment, which was done by the National Adoption and Fostering Centre, and then we had to apply for new money to get the actual treatment funded. And so it was a staggered process that just took months and months and months of chasing social workers to submit paperwork and fill out paperwork and get them us to sign it and all that kind of stuff.
And a formal complaint.
Yeah.
Make sure that everything went much quicker after that, yeah. To eventually lodge a formal complaint, yeah. Over the handling of it. And so the initial support was through our voluntary agency, and also because at that point they were still in care, the place with us, so they were able to support their, were able to access their adoption placement allowance, and then we transitioned to the adoption support fund. And
So the whole time that those conversations were ongoing, were you holding off applying for the adoption order?
Yes.
I mean, it's the absolute best thing to do, and significant pressure can be put on you to move that forward. And I've heard people talk about comments being made like, well, maybe you aren't the right parents for these children then, and so on, as a way of getting you to back down on the support that you're requesting. But you're so much more powerful before that adoption order goes through. I was chatting to some social workers recently, and I was talking about somebody who'd negotiated respite care for a child who had particularly high need and where child-to-parent violence was an issue. And the social worker was saying, how on earth did you get respite? We cannot get respite agreed, no matter what. And I said, because the adoption order hadn't been made yet. And they were saying, ah, oh, that'll be why then. They were saying the moment it's made, we cannot get one agreed at the moment.
And that's, we apply for the adoptions order after we had, after we thought the application for funding for the treatment with the National Adoption and Fostering Centre had been submitted. Turned out it hadn't been. Hence the formal complaint at the later stage. But the courts moved much more quickly than the social workers did. So it took us another few months after the order came through before we were able to start the treatment side of things. And we could really notice the lack of pace by that point from the social workers. And we were trying, they were trying to transition us away from the social worker we'd worked with, and who was also, you know, there were lots of other things going on that meant that actually she wasn't always able to support us in the way that even she would have wanted. And actually, we were, you know, going to the regional adoption agency, and that was, you know, trying to get a name of someone who we could actually even speak to at the regional agency took us a good month and a half, 2 months before we were able to do that. So the adoption order really meant that everybody was working and aligned and trying to do things. And still there were challenges, but then the challenge became much bigger once we, the courts were unfortunately faster than we had expected.
And so you had all of that intervention and that support. Was there a point for you each that you realised the adoption was now safe, that you were the right parents for these children, that they were the right children for you? Or was that more of a process?
There's a silence here because that's an interesting question. I don't think I don't think there was a point as such. I think we early on recognised that we had to be their parents as well, because the damage that it would do, that we would not, after having been told we were a forever family and all that kind of stuff, then not to have that, I think would have been really impactful for them and a very traumatic experience. So we were like, you know, while we felt, can we cope with this? There was also kind of, no, we have to cope with this. We have to find a way to cope with this because we have to be their parents. And I think after, so by August of lockdown year, so August 2020, September 2020, you know, we were having relatively calm nights. Night times, there were, you know, we didn't have huge violent outbursts during the day anymore. You know, they started reception and school, and that was challenging because they were, you know, not coping very well with it. And we had, you know, discussion with schools about how to deal with that. But actually, by that point, I think we really did feel, certainly I think, looking back, although I don't know if you'd asked me at the time, but I think that was the point where we really were their parents and acting as their parents, and we were going to be their parents. And we were just needing to make sure that we could be it. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. I was just thinking that since we moved, which is over a year ago, you know, we had a very difficult year moving, including, you know, with my own mental health about moving to a different country. And that has brought up some of the same and similar issues that we had during the lockdowns. But I feel better equipped, more exhausted, but better equipped to deal with it and to recognize what their issues are. And I think what it makes me reflect on is that to be an adopter is, yes, to be a parent, and I know people talk about this, but it's also to have an additional set of skills and to be really, to walk into that process with your eyes wide open about the fact that you do need to have an additional layer of strength to negotiate systems, to recognize that you are there to get the best support for your children, and also to be able to be more insightful for your children about what their needs are. So I think that absolutely at the beginning it was tough, but by the time that we got to them being in a UK state primary school, that, you know, we were much more settled.
Yeah.
And then also quite, you know, within a year or so, we had decided that actually we would move abroad. So we must have felt relatively confident at that point that was a safe future.
Yeah. And there's one thing that's interesting is the advocating for your child. It was part of our adoption process and the kind of, you know, the courses that we did. And I think our panel asked a question about how you would sort of advocate on behalf of your children and things like that, but I don't think the scale of which the advocating had to happen was really sunk in with me. I think it was much more over time it was like, oh, you really have to really fight sometimes with the system to get what you need, and I don't think you can realize that until you're in it and doing it. But the second thing is, I think that, you know, and I'm also mindful of prospective adopters listening to this podcast. And I think, and this is, I started earlier saying, you know, I didn't want to hear all the horror stories. And I feel, having talked, that we are sort of that horror story almost of how difficult it was. But there's two things that play in my mind: the what if scenario, what if we hadn't had COVID? Because that was such an additional traumatic experience that was so unaccountable for and so unexpected. And I'm not sure we would have ended up in the same difficult, challenging behavioral circumstances. They may have, I mean, the underlying issues are still there, but they wouldn't have been sort of additionally sort of brought up and scared and traumatized by that process. And so I feel that, you know, it's a unique circumstance, and I wouldn't want people to think that that is a kind of regular occurrence, this kind of escalation of things that happen. But at the same time, you know, there are in between all the difficult times, there have been some, you know, really lovely, helpful moments. We came with them to camp at one point, and they loved being there with other children. And, you know, and why I say that is because it's so nice for children who are adopted to think about it. Here in the Netherlands, they don't really come across adopted children in the same way because the care system works differently.
Yes.
It's permanent foster care instead of adoption as a kind of standard solution to these things, so they feel a bit different. But I know that from camp, and just after we'd adopted, actually just after we got the adoption order, we met with fellow adopters that we knew where we lived in the UK, and they had also just got the adoption order. It was a kind of post-COVID glut of them going through or something, and they were our children were talking to each other about, oh, we've just had our name changed, oh, you as well. And it was really nice, that recognition and that feeling of, oh, other children are going through this as well. And there were also a couple that called the parents dad, and I'm called papa because that's the Dutch word for dad. And this was also a couple that was from a other European country where they also use papa, and so they were like, oh, they call them the same thing. And it was really nice, those recognition moments and you know, feeling together. And I think those are really sweet moments that stand out. But also, like, even this morning, one of the boys woke up, and I went to his bedroom, and I sometimes lift him off out of bed, and he was there. Yeah, I'm ready for liftoff. And you know, that kind of, like, there's a lot of, and he gave me a bit of cuddle in the morning, and he's like, I slept really well. And, you know, it's like that kind of, there's a lot of sweetness and loveliness in between the difficult moments. And I think what was really nice as well for us during the process is that actually William, who was having all these challenges, really recognized that he struggled and he didn't want to struggle and he didn't want to feel like that. And he was able to voice that, and he was able to say, you know, I just feel, he's very quite meta, he loves his metaphors, and he said, you know, like, And sometimes I feel like after we moved house, he was having another moment of all of this, and he was like, "Yeah, it's like I'm a Coke bottle where you put a Mentos in, and normally the lid's okay, but I've lost the lid in the move, and it just comes out." And I'm like, "Yeah, you know," and it was nice to be able to sort of so there's a sense of. And I think that's partly what we've helped them with the support, and what we've learned about this process is we've given him words to voice what he's feeling, but it's also really lovely to see that he actually doesn't want to and is open to that help. Not always, bear in mind, there's moments where he's like, everybody just clear out, I just don't want to hear from you and nothing is right and everything is difficult. But there are moments where he's able to say, actually, I don't want to feel like this. I don't, what can I do about it?
And that you experience love that is so multi-layered and so complex that it really can bring you great joy into your life, and that's what I've taken away from that, from this whole 4 years of constant change in our lives, is that you can experience a sense of love that's so complex, so deep, that it's just really empowering to your everyday life.
I think that's a really lovely moment, actually, to draw this to a close. I think, you know, you said maybe this is one of those horror stories, but I don't think it is. I think it's one of those realistic stories about, you know, adoption is more complex. And so when we take that on, we take on that complexity. But you're right that in most cases, you end up with a child that you've fallen very deeply in love with. And that's a really wonderful thing. So it's that complexity. Is there anything either of you wants to say as advice for others or final thoughts before we finish?
I think, use places like New Family Social to find others. It's so nice to be able to talk to people who recognize what you're doing and what you're going through. And particularly when we were having our challenging moments, our family wasn't always able to understand, you know, the kind of, it was all COVID. So it was a lot of like phone calls and like what's going on, but also like not recognizing necessarily the kind of needs and difficulties and going, oh, but can you just, can that just be easily like, you know, if you just did differently, won't it fix it? And being able to talk with other adopters and people who experience that is nice, because you've got the moments of sharing and recognition of what you're going through. So I hope that we were able to come to camp again this year, maybe from where we are now, because it's really so valuable for what we are as parents and as LGBT adopters.
At the moment, I think a lot about families that I see on social media fighting for the rights of their children in the UK, and we experience here a different support system and a different way of working, which has been really refreshing for us to see two different examples. And I would say that, you know, change in the UK is possible, but it is exhausting to create that change, and it's really important that you don't lose a sense of yourself, that you actually really hold on to yourself and are open to the fact that this process isn't just about children changing, it's also about you changing and what you can gain from being able to access all that support once you've got it.
That's wonderful, thank you. And I hope you do both come to camp, because I can see you there. And we've got glamping now, it's all gone very upmarket, so you can have a glamping tent if you want. It's very, very posh, you get your own fairy lights and everything.
That sounds amazing.
It totally is. Well, I hope I'll see you there. I'd really like to thank you both for coming though. You've both spoken so openly and honestly and warmly. It's really lovely to hear, so thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for having us.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Henry and Duncan. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review and share it with your friends. Visit our website at newfamilysocial.org.uk. Adoption, Fostering and Tea is produced by New Family Social. The presenter was me, Tor Docherty, with music from Matt Docherty. The producer was John Jenkins. We'll be back next time with more guests and more tea.